some questions you might ask by Mary Oliver. Is the soul solid like iron, or is it tender and brittle like the wings of a moth in the beak of an owl? Who has it and who doesn't? I keep looking around me. The face of the moose is as sad as the face of Jesus. The swan opens her white wings slowly. In the fall, the black bear carries leaves into the darkness. One question leads to another. Does it have shape like an iceberg, like the eye of a hummingbird? Does it have one lung like the snake and the scallop? Why should I have it and not the anteater who loves her children? Why should I have it and not the camel? Come to think of it, what about the maple trees? What about the blue iris? What about all the little stones sitting alone in the moonlight? What about roses and lemons and their shining leaves? What about the grass? We've arrived at question round number one. The first round of questions will be limited to those submitted in advance.
That I've already seen. Oh.
I will try questions from the box, read them out loud, and Reverend Lucy will answer any question you may have submitted in advance that we don't get to in this round. We'll go into the box of questions submitted today, so they'll have an opportunity to be answered in the second or final Jeopardy round. Let's begin with the first. Dear Reverend Lucy, how do you keep in touch with your spirituality?
Oh, wow, this is a good question. Oh, who's this from? Julia McMichaels. Where are you, Julia? Hi, Julia. I think this is a good question, and having just come from a 5-day silent retreat, which was all about spirituality, it reminds me of the challenge of the day-to-day. And a fellow minister friend of mine said at this retreat that she has two parts of her life, work and the void. And I realize that that's easy for me to fall into that trap where work and I don't know what to do with myself. And so I have a lot of things that I do that enrich my life, like my singing group that I'm in, gardening, cooking, trying to make things that are part of my life that help keep me energized and alive and are not so much about work. And then I have my Tai Chi practice, which is really my biggest form of spiritual practice. So I encourage any of you to think of all those things you do that you do because you love them as a way of feeding your spirit. That was a nice softball question. I like that one.
The next question.
Yeah, name them as you do the.
Michael Miller.
Oh, Michael Miller.
We can't hear you. Can you speak into the microphone?
Hello? Better? Okay. Michael Miller asks, what is the area that the lay leaders should be focusing on in order to improve or enhance the fulfillment of the congregation's mission, values, and covenants?
Thank you, Michael. I see you sitting there. Well, I think this is a really easy one. I love these softball questions because the strategic plan. I think all the leaders in the congregation, in fact, everyone, I think, needs to look at that strategic plan because there's not a detailed action plan about where we're going to go from here because we know in a congregation this size, we can't say, now we're going to do this. It has to come from all of you and what calls you in the world. And so the strategic plan is really all about having goals and objectives, and we're the action plan. And so the leaders really need to help channel the energy of the congregation in directions that support the future that we've laid out for ourselves in that plan.
Tracy Jones asks, what holds UUSS back from the mission of coming together to deepen our lives and be a force for good in the world?
It's always a dilemma as a minister. How much do you say? You always want to be helpful. You don't want to make people feel bad, right? I mean, I could answer that question in a lot of ways, but I want to answer it in a helpful way. Read it again, please, MC.
This is a classic Dutch.
Whose side are you on, Jed?
Okay.
Hi, Tracy. What holds UUSS back? All right. I think there's a timidity about stepping into leadership. I think we have to get over that. I think this is not, as our president of the UUA says, this is not time for a casual faith. This is the time. This is the great turning. This is the time. And if you feel called to do something, this is not the time to be demure. This is the time to step up and help and support. And if you want something to happen, you need to be part of the team that makes it happen. The other thing I think I've noticed in this congregation, and I actually think it comes from being part of a bureaucratic town, there's a real scarcity mentality. And I worked in a bureaucracy for many years, so I understand that mentality. But there's a scarcity mentality. There's this sense of we have to hoard what we have because there's never enough. And I think that holds us back. And I'd love for us to have a more vision of expansiveness and this idea that we can make more of what we need by our energy and our commitment. So those would be two of the things that I would offer up for that question, Tracy. Oh, thank you.
Sharon Alexander asks,
Since
other traditions also emphasize being humble as a virtue, I consulted a dictionary, and the uses seem to emphasize a disposition of meekness. A Dickens character I remember played this role, but in fact was cunning and not a genuine caring person. The only alternative definition that made sense to me was respectful. What do we UUs mean by humble?
Are you here, Sharon? Hi, Sharon. I preached on this a while ago, and I don't think UUs hold a wisdom on humility, but my perspective as a UU minister is that humility is the fulcrum between thinking you're the most wonderful thing on earth and thinking that you're terrible. It's the emotionally healthy place where you accept your failings and your frailties, but you also accept what's wonderful and good about you. So humility for me is a sense of wholeness. And it really works for me to think of it as a fulcrum. You know, a fulcrum's like on a teeter-totter. And one end of that fulcrum is, I'm the best thing there is. And the other end of that fulcrum is, I'm worthless. And humility is the healthy, emotional, mature place in the center of that.
Jenny Johnson asks, how do you split your duties as a minister, or what percentage of time do you spend on each category of your duties?
Are you here, Jenny? I don't. Okay, I guess we'll pass on that one. How do you want me to answer it? I have a plan, I have a list, I'm very organized, and then there's a call because somebody's in the hospital and the plan goes out the window. So then I work extra long that day, that's the reality. And that's why I do this, is I love the aliveness of it. You know, I spent years in a bureaucratic environment and I love the authenticity and aliveness of this work, but part of it is you can never predict. I know I'm gonna be here on Sunday mornings, I know that I have to preach on a regular basis, but other than that, it's just ding, 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 ding.
Apparently, this is a popular topic. Tracy Jones asks, what did you discover about professional ministry that you could not have known as a lay leader?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I was a lay leader. Oh, hi again, Tracy. I was a lay leader for a long time. I was a UU for 25 years before I became a minister, and a serious leader in my congregation. I think I couldn't, and one of my challenges, because I was an administrator at the University of California, Davis, one of my challenges was learning how my leadership skills from my work transferred to leadership in a congregation. And I think two things that I didn't understand as a layperson. I didn't really understand how much you love your congregation. How do you love 500 people, right? But you do. I love this entity of who you are. And when I'm up there preaching, I feel like I'm in a relationship with all of you. And you can't really comprehend that as a layperson. And I preached maybe 5 times a year before I became a minister. So being with you in worship on a regular basis builds this relationship that I don't think I could really understand and appreciate. And then I didn't understand leadership as a minister is very different from leadership as a layperson, because you try to figure out the vision that is useful for the congregation, and with us on our strategic plan, we have that vision laid out. But you don't drag people to that vision, you don't push them to that vision, you just kind of encourage and herd and gently be present, and it's a very different, more of a Taoist form of leadership, the leadership from behind, and so that's been a real learning for me about the difference between lay leadership and ministry.
We have time for one or possibly two more questions. How does one politely and with respect, this is from Karen Robinson, respectfully answer someone who asserts that UUs can believe anything?
I saw you, Karen. Where are you? Hey, Karen. Yeah. All right. I got this one. I'm a minister. I know the answer to this one. I try to cut that off right away, and in our newcomer orientation, I always say this. When people say, you know, well, UUs can believe anything, and what do you believe as UUs? I say, you know, Unitarian Universalism is not about belief. It's about living our lives in a way that is transformational for ourselves and for the world. It's about caring and loving and being engaged. And so we don't focus on belief. We don't have a creed. I try to redirect it totally from the focus on belief. But I also love to take on that question, we can believe whatever we want, because that's baloney. We can't believe things that aren't life-giving. We can't believe in things that are damaging and hurtful. We can't believe in things that say it has to be just this way and not other ways. And so I like to call them out in that regard. You know, belief is not important to us, but there are things you can't believe that are about not life-giving things. We don't believe in things that are hard for our web, that destroy our interdependent web of all existence. There's the bell. Okay.
I'm afraid that's our time for now.
Okay.
What should we do about that moon? Written by Hafiz. A wine bottle fell from a wagon and broke open in a field. That night, 100 beetles and all their cousins gathered and did some serious binge drinking. They even found some seed husks nearby and began to play them like drums and whirl. This made God very happy. Then the night candle rose into the sky, and one drunk creature, laying down his instrument, said to his friend, for no apparent reason, what should we do about that moon? Seems to Hafiz, most everyone has laid aside the music. Tackling such profoundly useless questions. Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached question round number 2. Please note that no questions have left this platform at any time, and I am now taking the questions submitted today and adding them to the question box.
You better shake it up, too.
Okay.
Oh, don't you have something to read before this one?
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah.
Again from the attorneys, regrettably, we were obliged to remove those that did not have a name or were inappropriate for a worship
service.
There
weren't any that were inappropriate.
Questions submitted in advance that were not answered in the first round are included in this lightning round. If your question is not picked today, Reverend Lucy invites you to make an appointment with her to have your question answered in person. Let's begin with the first question. Can you share, Celia Buckley asks, Dear Reverend Lucy, can you share how you connect with Kuan Yin?
Oh, my. So Kuan Yin is the goddess of mercy and compassion. I guess you could say Kuan Yin saved my life at a very low point in my life, feeling really lost and not very good about myself, feeling like a failure. I started a practice with Kuan Yin. This came out of my Zen practice at Green Gulch Farm in Marin. And I got very inspired to just hang out with Kuan Yin and learn to let her love me. And that practice, and it's continued to be an almost daily practice in my life, really taught me to find love and compassion for myself. And it's been a very, very powerful practice. Of course, after about 10 years of doing that, I figured out that I was generating the love that I was feeling from her. You know, it's a circular, but it really helped me find compassion for myself and made a big difference in my life.
I need a handwriting analyst.
Ask them to raise their hand.
Raise your hand if you wrote the question. There's a gentleman at the entrance to our church.
Oh. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a gentleman at the entrance to our church who holds a sign that says, Democracy is dead. Any idea why? I'd like to know that.
His name is Dave. What's his last name? David Jacobs. So David Jacobs was a member of this congregation, been a part of this congregation for quite some time, regularly attends the Ted's Web political discussion. And at the time when we voted on this building structure, and I'm doing my best because he's never articulated to me what his concern is, so this is like third hand, but this is what I believe to be his concern. We voted to spend $3.5 million renovating our building. And we raised it. We did, yeah. And we had to take out a loan for part of it because of some, the cost had gone up, and there was a lot of requirements that the county placed on us that were almost $1 million that were completely invisible. They were about grading our property for the floodplain. We actually had to raise the level of the floor by 8 inches. And Dave had a background in something related to civil engineering, and he didn't agree with what the county wanted us to do. And he felt like he was not being heard when he would tell us that we didn't have to do it that way and we should go back to the county and articulate that to them. So he voted against the building plan, and he seems to be very stuck in the idea that his voice was not included in the process. The vote was like, 198-4 or something like that to do the project. So I encourage all of you to greet him, ask him how you can help him, ask him to talk about what his experience here was. He says he'll send you an email, but I haven't heard from anybody who said he's actually sent them an email with what his concern is. But please reach out to him. We love him. We care about him. That's his calling right now. So say hi to him. Don't be afraid of him. And hopefully someday he'll feel more comfortable not needing to stand out there.
Joan Gilbert asks, what do Unitarians think about evil? Individuals have the possibility of redemption, but is there not evil in the world, and how can we recognize it and confront it?
Okay. So I'm preaching on evil next year. I'm doing a sermon series. It's called A Theology for the 21st Century. So one of the sermons is going to be on this topic, but I'm going to give you the short version. And this is what, I'm one Unitarian Universalist minister, and there's been a challenge to Unitarian Universalists that we don't have a strong enough theology of evil. But let me just give you the sense of our theology of evil. Because if you believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person or even every being, what's the place in evil in that? I don't think that we believe in absolutes, that this black and white idea that there's pure evil and there's pure goodness, or everything's either black or white. I think all humans have the capacity for evil. And being in the context of the distance from good, people who either have mental challenges or who are disconnected from life and love and spirit can do evil things out of their pain and their difficulty or just how the neurons on their brain are organized. But it doesn't make any of those people worthless or horrible. They are just in their in their challenge and struggle with how they are on this earth at this time, they're doing evil acts as a result of the challenges that they faced. So you're going to have to stay tuned for more, probably in April, a more expansive version of that.
Tamara Olson asks, Reverend Lucy, how was your experience at the silent retreat?
How was my experience at the silent retreat? Well, I reached Nirvana at lunch on Wednesday with a plate of nectarines that were the most delicious nectarines I'd ever eaten in my life. And at the Vesper service that night, there was some question about what has called you or what are you called or what has been revealed to you, and we had to write it down on a little post-it, and I wrote, nectarines are God.
We seem to once again be on a similar subject. Another questioner, Sharon and Jan Whitehead Van Lobensels, ask, if God created everything, how do we reconcile evil?
Well, the challenge, I mean, I would say a lot of us don't believe that God created everything. And there I'm using that word believe again. A lot of us don't have a construct of a God that controls and created everything. But if you read the book of Job, God actually partners up with Satan to mess with Job, so to prove how to challenge Job and his worthiness. And that's I might preach on Job. That's a great story from the Hebrew Scriptures. So evil, you know, God may well have wanted evil as a tool, a challenge to humans. Evil requires that humans have free will to make choices. And so God perhaps wanted humans to be able to make choices for their own lives. If you have this construct that God created everything.
Surprisingly, in a similar vein, Michael Miller asks, for me, the ends do not justify the means, and that how we do something is as important as what the results are. Given that, how do I reconcile the actions that I don't agree with that are taken by groups struggling for justice?
Oh, Michael Miller! That's a hell of a question and a really important question. But if we think of our world as a family, or we think of our community of justice makers as a family, I don't think it's that hard. I don't think that we have room in our world right now for absolutes. So you have people sitting around the table in your family, and some of them have different opinions, some of them don't like meat, some of them, and you just work with what you have. You work with what you have. I don't think we have the privilege of not participating in justice activities because we don't like some of the things that we hear. But that doesn't mean we have to identify ourselves with a particular movement that makes us uncomfortable. There's plenty of ways to do work. So let's just name Black Lives Matter, which I know some people have some discomfort with some of the techniques that they use. First of all, voices that haven't been able to be heard for hundreds of years I think we need to open our hearts to maybe they're going to speak more stridently. If you had been shut up for hundreds of years, you might not say things perfectly right that white people can relate to and appreciate. So we need to be kind about that. But also, there are many ways that you can do justice work if you just have a need to align yourself only with all the ideas that work with you, work for you. There are a lot of ways that you can do justice work that is in your particular lane, your particular wheelhouse. There are plenty of ways. And in terms of racism issues, there are lots of groups of white people that are getting together and talking to each other and trying to figure out this whole white supremacy thing, which is so challenging and uncomfortable and difficult. So don't throw away groups of people that are really doing their thing to change the world without trying to understand them. Take what works for you and leave the rest. You don't have to be a representative of them wearing a t-shirt and a button to care about what they do and to do work for justice in the world. Thank you, Michael, for asking that.
She's pretty good at this. As we're coming towards the end of our time, David Dawson asks, do you know a good joke about Unitarians, and provides an example. The answer is, they're the ones who burn question marks in your lawn.
Yes, Dave, I know that joke. Thank you. Do we have time for a couple more? Mr. Master of Ceremonies?
I believe we can squeeze a couple more in.
Okay.
How do Unitarian, a simple question.
Who's
Mario,
this from?
Mario Giacomo. How do Unitarian Universalists differentiate between faith and trust?
Are you here, Mario? Do you see him? Hi. Thank you for asking. So again, you know, you can't, Unitarians, oh my God, how could you ever define, right? We're all over the place. But I'll speak from my own experience about that question and what I've learned. And I see trust as a relationship between yourself and another person or an entity or an organization where you have personal experience so that you can believe that that person is true to their word or follows through on things. Some people say they have trust in God or trust in Jesus, and they have a relationship with what God or Jesus means to them. So trust to me feels like something that's based in an interaction that allows you to have confidence that that person is going to be the person, being, organization that you believe them to be. Whereas faith, I wish I could remember this quote really well, but it's like, you know, walking up a staircase and not knowing where the staircase is going to lead. Faith is believing that things will happen the way you'd like them to happen or the way you hope that they would happen, even if you don't really know whether it is or not. It's continuing to walk down the path, even if you're not absolutely sure that path is going to go in the direction that you want to go. So faith is more of a something you hold in your heart. Something that you ground yourself in with things like belief in the goodness of human beings or feelings about the nature of the universe, and so that you know that if you do good works in the world, you have faith that ultimately that's going to make a difference. And I think our relationship with the interdependent web is a lot about faith. You know, I really, really know in my heart that the things that I do, the small acts that I do, make a difference, but I do that on faith. Because I'm saying these words today, I have no how, I believe that some of what I've said today is landed on some of you in some way that is going to, you're going to be in the world differently than you were at 10:30 this morning. But that's a matter of faith. I don't know, and I may never know. Make it an easy one.
Oh, actually, the softball pitch.
Okay.
Tracy Jones asks, what are three critical moments, people, or events to know about UU history?
Oh, my God. I did a sermon on that. Go online. Great, four great moments in UU history. I think we have to understand the origins of our two denominations and how we came out of Calvinism and the heretical statements that were the founding ideas of who we were. And if you come to our history class, one of our exploring classes, you'll hear that. I think the 20th century, early 20th century, was a pivotal moment for both Unitarians and Universalists, because after World War II, a lot of people lost faith in humans, lost faith that everything was ever going to be good again. And both of our denominations really had to scramble to find meaning and purpose during that time. And humanism emerged after the First World War, which was an important part of our 20th century experience of Unitarian Universalism. And then, because I'm a huge fan of the Seventh Principle, the moment that the Seventh Principle was voted on as an amendment to a change to our principles, this idea of our interdependent web, I think it gave birth to what ultimately is the most important thing for us to know as we go forward as UUs in the 21st century. So, that's it. I think we're done.
All right. Well, this is an incredibly brilliant group. Great questions answered by an incredibly brilliant woman.